Welcome to Humanity Unites, a UN human rights podcast series. I'm Kaloy Henry from UN Human Rights. What you've just heard is music from Afro-Cuban rapper Robe El Nino, whose work looks at challenging expectations and representation, which is also the subject of today's episode, Representation of People of African Descent Through the Lens of the Arts as a Way to Challenge Perception. In addition to Robe, we'll hear from a journalist who ensured proper Afro-Latina representation on the Disney animation Encanto, an engineer-turned-choreographer demystifying myths in Hong Kong, and how the decade for people of African descent has helped ease the way for representation. Stay tuned. Representation matters, and for people of African descent, the challenge of proper or even accurate representation is ongoing. It was one of the themes for the Decade for People of African Descent, which culminates this year. Edna Liliana Valencia is someone who has focused much of her life on the importance of representation of Black people. She is an award-winning Afro-Colombian journalist and author whose memoir, Racism and Me, delves into issues of representation, stereotypes, and discrimination. Edna used her skills as a consultant for Disney on its animation Encanto, helping to portray Colombia's beauty and diversity accurately. She's in conversation with Yvonne Villavaitia.
I was born in Bogota, Colombia, the capital of my country. So it's a white majority population city. And I was the only Black girl in my kindergarten, in my neighborhood, in my school, with my sister, of course. Even in my family, because I grew up with the non-Black part of my family. So I feel that I grew up very alone, you know, not only in terms of the people around me, but also in terms of representation. When I used to see, for example, TV shows, I don't used to see Black people. When I went to the school to study, I don't remember to see anybody Black in my storybooks or in my biology books. I don't even remember that they teach me something about Africa in my geography books, you know? And the first and only reference about Blackness or Afro-descendant culture in my school was slavery. I remember a sentence. I was in the second grade in the primary. And the teacher said, like, they bring Black slaves from Africa. And the first time that I saw someone like me in a history book was with no clothes, you know, naked, and in a subordination role, you know. It was only men, not even one woman. I remember to being a girl playing with white dolls, with Barbie, the traditional Barbie, for example, and feeling myself ugly, hating my hair, hating the color of my skin. So at the end, when I grew up and I understood that lie about Africa's only poverty, only slavery, Black people is not in Colombia. That's a very big lie. We are more than 16 million people, Black people in Colombia. When I understood all that fake story, I started also to change my self-recognizement, you know, the self-perception I have about, of course, myself. And I start to dream with the possibility to change that story for the new generations of Black girls of my country in Latin America. At the end, is the motivation I have today to tell a different story for the new generations.
Let's talk about Encanto, the Disney animation film. You worked as a consultant in Afrocentric representation. How was that experience and what did your job consist of?
I was anchoring the news in France 24 in Spanish in 2020, and they called me from Disney Animation Studio to be the consultant in Black representation to the movie. They picked me to help them to create a good representation of Black population in Colombia, you know, through the music, through the hairstyles. That is a very important topic to myself. It's one of the main topics of my life in terms of activism, journalism, entrepreneurship. So Afro hair is one of the tools I use to talk about racism and why we used to grow up hating being Black people. So to me, it was very important to put Black people in that movie, but with dignity, creating a representation of dignity in the movie. We represent my region of my father's family, that is Chocó region. It's a department of Colombia in the Pacific Coast, 100% Black population. We have also all the types of hair, you know, from the straight hair to the afro hair in the different members of the family, Madrigal. So that's very nice because it's the first time you can see a complete representation of hairs, textures of hairs in a family in a Disney movie. We have, for example, representation of Palenque, El Palenque de Encogiojo. Palenque was the first free town in the whole continent in the slavery age. And is in our days, it's patrimony of the humanity. Very nice because Dolores, one of the members of the family, her dress is a Palenque dress, is a cumbia dress. So she represents women of the Caribbean coast of Colombia. We also have Felix. I create all the hairstyle, the dress. Felix is wearing a guayabera. That is a very important clothes. I don't know how to call that. It's a very important...
I think it's more a shirt, la guayabera,
yes,
right?
Yes, a shirt is a very important piece of clothes of the Caribbean coast.
So Lily, do you think that the representation of people of African descent in the popular culture can play a role in combating racism and racist stereotypes?
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Even because we have to say that we have been always in the popular culture. But there's another topic that is very important to talk about, and it's cultural appropriation, you know? I think all the music around the world, a lot of expressions of the popular culture are from African descent, you know, or from diaspora, this African diaspora descent. But the cultural appropriation have been creating the idea that everything is from Europe, everything is white. Europe is not only white at the end, you know. But we have the idea that Europe is white just because the racism has make us believe that. In our days, we are learning to claim our rights about it, you know? So yeah, for sure, there is a change in the last 10 years, 15, 20 years, you know? But we have to continue talking about this kind of topics, for example, in this space. We have to continue creating a change. But just to finish this answer, there's a lot of people talking about they are worried because in the next, for example, in the next Disney movie, there will be only Black people or only gay people. That's the other worry they have, you know. So no, but this is very worried because for the next, they will be only Black people. That's very bad. Excuse me, you have thousands of movies about only white people. Why we can't have one movie about only Black people? But for the moment, we are just trying to have a couple spaces in the industry, you know? For example, with the debate of the mermaid, it shows a lot of resistance to change. And that's racism at the end. I mean, white society, the ones that have the privilege. So they don't want to lose the privilege. They want to keep it like that. They want the mermaid continue to be white. They want only white people in Encanto. They want only white prizes in the Oscars, you know? There's a lot of resistance of change, but this is a change that will continue going on.
I wanted to talk about your book now, Racism and Me, El Racismo y Yo, which is a memoir. I wanted to ask you, what is this book about and what compelled you to write it?
I started to write poetry when I was 12 years old, you know? So I was wondering to publish a poetry book during the last 10 years, you know? But at the end, I decided to talk about my personal story to show people how racism is still alive in our societies in Latin America, specifically in Colombia, but around the world also, you know? Because also I feel, and I'm sure, that I'm the perfect person that can demonstrate that racism exists. Why? Because I'm Black, of course, but I'm kind of light-skinned. I don't like that kind of concepts because I don't consider myself as a light-skinned girl, but I understand that it's people with darker skin like that mine, you know? I'm a person from the mass media, so we can say that I'm famous, you know? So people start to say like, But Liliana, racism doesn't exist to you because you're famous. But Liliana, racism doesn't exist to you because you're rich. I'm not rich. But Liliana, but you're not that dark skin. You don't have that kind of dark skin, that kind of face, that kind of nose, that kind of mouth. So racism is not about yourself. It's not your topic, you know? And if myself, with the position I have in the media and the mass media in Latin America and Colombia, with the position I have working with, for example, enterprises like Disney Animation Studios, still, when I go out, for example, a cab don't want to stop to me. And racism is structural. And me as a Black person, I'm a victim of structural racism. If I am a victim, try to imagine what happened with Black women with dark skin from the rural areas, not education, and not communication ways, you know? And all I want with the book is to put light in front of the racism that is an enemy, an invisible enemy we can't sometimes recognize. So if you're a white person, you will learn a lot about the book. If you are a Black person, you will learn a lot about the book. It's just my personal life, my personal poetry, but I think it's very necessary that Black women, Black young women from Latin America, we start to tell our own stories.
Next, we move from the world of animation to the world of dance. Anisha Tai is a social media content creator, dancer, and choreographer living in Hong Kong. Born to a mother from Comoros and a father from Vietnam, she grew up in Paris and studied to be a civil engineer. She moved away to Hong Kong as a way to both work in her field and to connect with the Asian side of her roots. And while there, she also reconnected with her love of dance and discovered that through dance and choreography, she could challenge assumptions about what it means to be Black and living in Asia.
I've always been super fascinated by high-rise buildings, architecture. So I studied civil engineering in Paris, got my master's degree, and I was like, okay. To be honest with you, the real reason is that I wanted to challenge myself, grow, get into another environment. But also there was that side of me, I'm Asian, basically. And I feel like growing up in France was a bit challenging because there are cliches when it comes to being Asian, right? And there's also cliche when it comes to being Black. So I got both of them. So I was like, this is enough. And I want to, you know, really get to know myself in the place that's where my parents are from. So that's why I decided Asia, especially Hong Kong. I've always danced my whole life. My mom always danced with me since I was able to walk. And I believe dance is the best form of expression for me when it comes to sharing who I am, my truth, how I feel. It's just that I believe as a person of color in France, I've always felt that I needed to prove that I'm able to have a successful career in the prestigious, you know, career such as civil engineering. And otherwise my mom would tell me, oh, if you don't study well, you will end up like these other people, like Black people on the streets, like cleaning and everything. So I guess I wanted to prove myself that it was possible. And so I studied civil engineering. But then at the end of the day, I realized that my heart belongs to art and dance and self-expression, where I'm like, okay, I'm a civil engineer. Should I continue the career ladder and going up and getting a stable job, better salary and everything? Or should I give it a try? I'm like 27 now. What should I do? And I think what happened is that I just listened to myself and I stepped back and I realized that I did so much already. And most of it, I didn't do it for myself. I did it for my parents to show the society that I'm capable and everything. So I felt like I needed to take the leap of it, the gap, to jump the gap. And that's why I, after winning the dance competition, I decided to do like fully being a full, you know, dancer. I was the only foreigner. I was the only Black woman. And my intention was to showcase, share my story and my background. You know, the when I say background, it's not just the African side, to mix together, like make a fusion of both of my roots, which is Afro-Asian. So I ended up on stage for the final and I brought Hong Kong local dancers. I brought my African drummers and I played French music because I am French still, you know. And the three together creating, I think it created such a a powerful environment where I was like, oh, this is home for me. But it was a magical moment that I will never forget in my life. Yeah. I think there's not enough representation when it comes to like, yeah, people of color being leaders, like being successful in their career and you know. So I believe my way, my approach for social media is to create my own narrative, share my story, and also provide another reference, another model that I was missing when I was younger. So I wanted to become my own model. And I wanted also to inspire my future, you know, the new generation. So that's why when I started social media, I thought I was one of the only ones doing what I was doing. But then I realized the more I shared my voice, the more I shared my story, it connected people. It brought people on my platform. And I realized that there's more people like me. There's more people like not just talented, but, you know, like in any fields, actually. And I feel like because one person starts opening up and raising their voice, it attracts the other people. It makes them feel comfortable to really create that like safe environment where all together we are a community. And I believe we need to connect the dots together by just connecting, you know. And I believe the power of social media is very important in that sense. So on my platform, I talk a lot about my experiences, like when it comes to facing racism, for example. There were so many like modeling gigs where I applied because the title was "We're looking for Asian model," for example. So I applied and I said, "Hey, I'm interested." And saying, "No, you're not Asian." And I said, "Well, I'm sorry, I'm Asian." And they saying, "No, you're black. You're African. You look like African." And I'm like, "Oh, okay." So I think it's very important for me to question, challenge, what it is to be black, what it is to be Asian, what it is to be African. You know, it's not about the color. It's way more than that. And we cannot let people define who we are. We cannot let people invent our identity. Not limiting ourselves is very important because we might be influenced by our environment because of the people that are around us. So because there's not that many African people around us that do whatever career we dream of, we believe that we cannot do it. But actually, we need to get outside of the box and connect with other people and look at the whole world, actually. And being confident, trusting ourselves in taking action and following our plan, because everybody has a plan, everybody has a purpose. And find that purpose and do not give up on it.
Music has always been a way to break down barriers and share messages. Robe El Nino does just that. Robe is not only a musician, but a hairstylist and a social activist from Cuba who uses his music to fight racism and racial stereotypes, as well as spread messages of positivity and pride.
Para mí, la música precisamente fue eso, el vehículo.
For me, music is precisely that, a vehicle, a weapon, a tool that I use in these times to decolonize minds. Colonization in these lands is something that people have deeply embedded in their minds. This is because they indoctrinate us since we are children. Historiography makes us believe in facts that never existed, and also in facts that were only told from one side. So with this base, narratives are built to keep you submissive, to keep you being a second-class person in these societies. But through music, we are turning this idea around, and this has had a big following. I am also doing this so that new generations feel pride and not shame, as racism wants them to feel. So they should live with pride instead of shame, as racists want. People have appropriated my music as a way of responding to racist attacks, as a way of self-identifying and finding answers to what they are going through.
Identificarse, ¿sabes? De encontrar como respuesta a algunos tipos de procesos que están viviendo en el momento y demás.
This year marks the closing of the first decade for people of African descent. The decade has been an opportunity to explore the themes of recognition, justice, and development for the more than 200 million people of African descent living outside the African continent. Dominique Day is a member of the UN Working Group of Experts on People of African Descent. She is a human rights attorney and has spent the last two decades focused on racial justice, non-discrimination, and human rights advocacy. She's also the founder of Daylight, and I started out by asking her to explain this organization.
Daylight is an access to justice platform. We look at racial justice intersectionally, which means we actively incorporate gender, sexual orientation, gender identity, immigration status, all of these sort of intersectional identities to really celebrate people as who they are in their entirety, to really talk about how communities operate in reality, and to try to promote solutions that have more relevance, more complexity, more authenticity, more genuine possibility for change.
Give me an example of one of these authentic solutions that Daylight's helped to come up with.
I do some work with big law firms and corporations, and I often do trainings where we're reducing the intervention to a series of hypothetical situations. What would you do if this happens? Now, the hypotheticals secretly are things that are happening all the time. Black people walking into court, Black lawyers walking into court and being assumed to be court reporters or members of the staff and never being understood to be lawyers, even by the judges they've appeared in front of. These are things happening all the time. We have people talking about them, and yet they're really invisibilized and kind of pushed aside as white noise by the mainstream. And so a way to actually uplift our failures of inclusion and belonging, our failures to really unravel the ways white supremacy continues to structure these spaces, starts by bringing them out into the open, by having conversations about how different people's experiences are in these same places and how invisible that can be.
What was the moment for you where you said, something needs to be done? I got to do something about this.
And I think that for me, the moment where I said something needs to be done was when I thought I was living my dream, right? I had finished law school. I was a public defender. I realized that even fighting the racism and discrimination in the system made me a part of a system that was inherently erasing of my clients, erasing of the harms it was doing to them, right? You arrest somebody for 2 days on a trespass charge, which was a very big thing in New York City for a long time and even still a little bit now. And where are their children? What's happening to their job? What's happening to their rent payments? And the answers to these were devastating. People's lives were so precarious, and especially Black people's lives in New York City were so precarious that they were devastated from this little blip that, to be honest, would probably devastate all of us, but the recovery process was almost impossible. And so for me, that became one area to just pivot, to recognize that although I was fighting case by case in court, I wasn't necessarily disrupting a system that allowed me to fight and dismiss a case, but not to allow my clients to live with dignity and with honor. And this offered something really important for me as a platform to think about what I needed Daylight to be and how I needed it to approach things differently.
You have this very strong, both personal and professional encounter and story and discourse, you know, with the issues and with the situation. How do you think that helps you to get people to care about the issues or people to engage with the issues in a way that's meaningful?
I think that's a great question. I think for me, it's tricky how I motivate, how I engage, how I create meaningful opportunities for cooperation and synergy. Because although I walk through the world bodied this way as a Black woman, as a Black lesbian, I'm also an American. I'm also deeply privileged compared to people all over the world. I think for me, what I found is that when I'm most capable and most successful is when I allow my experiences to inform my understandings without trying to impose them on anybody else. And so I know what it is to be in an education system and to be assumed to be not smart or not having a potential or not deserving of opportunities to shine, not able to contribute in a way beyond how they've decided my race creates my future, right? Without unpacking the racialized ways that their mind operates due to the social conditioning of race in our society, you know, this is something that people have a sense of the injustice, have a sense of the unfairness, but can't always put a name to it and are consistently confronted with, oh, you're making things up, it's a lazy explanation, you're wrong, nobody thinks like that, that's not intentional, that's not our intention, right? And so it's really hard to have conversations about what's really happening when you have this really well-developed culture of denial that is packed around every incident of systemic racism.
Yeah, that's a funny one when you basically say, oh, nobody thinks like that. That one comes up a lot. So let's make a small pivot. The decade for people of African descent is probably supposed to be coming to an end this year, but of course there is a move to create a second decade. So two-part question for you on this one. One, what do you think has been the biggest achievement of this current decade? And two, if there is a second decade and the second decade goes on, what would you like it to do? What would you like to be the outcome of the second decade?
I would say, without a doubt, the biggest achievement of this decade has been the creation of the Permanent Forum. The Permanent Forum for People of African Descent has been an amazing breath of fresh air. The Permanent Forum has been a space, I think, that we had advocated for its creation for years and years and years. There was a real opportunity after the murder of George Floyd in 2020 when member states were looking to show some fidelity to the idea that they needed to be doing something against systemic racism, against anti-Blackness. And the Permanent Forum was created. What makes it really special is the investment and the ownership of civil society. So literally thousands of people of civil society from all over the world have flocked to the Permanent Forum sessions. People have spoken out and spoken powerfully about what they're experiencing in their own spaces. They have shown connections, transnational connections of anti-Blackness that are really powerful and that persist despite differences in development, differences in language, differences in what we would call culture. It gives me hope for all of the mechanisms, and it gives me a lot of hope just generally, because I think it offers a real opportunity for civil society and people with the most lived expertise to be setting the agenda for what we're doing to improve the human rights for situation of people of African descent. In terms of what would happen in the next decade, all the things that didn't happen in this decade, very few governments launched the decade. I think until we see governments really launching it and really thinking about their own complicity in anti-Blackness, their own reliance on anti-Blackness for labor pools, for self-image, right? It can be really hard for governments in Europe to really confront what's happened in the past, but more importantly, the legacies of that today. And what we've often found is when we try to talk about racism and anti-Blackness in Europe, they try to pivot the conversation to minority status as though anti-Blackness can be resolved. To me, the decade is a perfect opportunity to really start asking those questions and really start interrogating and confronting our own biases, our own complicity, our own investment, and our own profit from anti-Blackness. That extends all the way back to the trade and trafficking in enslaved Africans, right? That extends back to the creation of a modern global transnational economy on leveraging the labor, the intellectual property, the fertility, the lives, the families, the land, and the resources of people of African descent. Until we really confront that, it's really hard to see how you would unravel the systemic racism that persists today, and that is measurable.
Well, we've come to the end of this episode of Humanity Unites, looking at representation and breaking stereotypes for people of African descent. I want to thank all our guests, Edna Valencia, Anisha Tai, Robe El Nino, and Dominique Day, for taking part. If you want to learn more about any of the issues raised in this podcast, then please go to our website, www.ohchr.org. We leave you now with a bit more of Robe's music. This song is called N-E-G-R-O, and it celebrates Black identity in all its splendor. I'm Kayloy Henry. Thanks for listening. Hey, hey, hey.
fuerte, por favor. Rimas claras para el buen entendedor. Ah, hoy vengo a expresarle mi sentir cantando, aunque no soy tenor, el orgullo que siento por mi color. Y es que yo soy negro, como el Rey Pelé, como Usain Bolt, como Tupac, Bob Marley, Benny, como Biggie Smalls, Rosa Parks, Erykah Badu, Javier Sotomayor.